antiwar.com and Chaos Radio in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. For the first time since probably age 7 or 8 years old, I'm reading Playboy for the articles. No lie.
Right.
Richard Cummings is my guest, and he's written an article for the newest Playboy, the January Playboy, called Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels.
Scott, let me just interject that this article is on the Playboy website, playboy.com, and it's actually not going to be in the magazine. It's exclusively on playboy.com.
Oh, really? It's not in the magazine?
No.
Oh, I was going to say, run out to the newsstand. It's the one with the cute blonde on the front.
Well, all you have to do is you can get it free. You go to playboy.com, and it comes right up.
All right, good. And that's, again, that's Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking
Barrels. Yes.
And, you know, people still argue about the Iraq War. Why did America invade Iraq? Why are we still there? That kind of thing. Is it oil? Is it Israel? Basically, Richard Cummings, you make the case that it's all about selling airplanes.
Well, pretty much so. I'm pretty convinced of that, and I became convinced of that the more I researched this.
Okay, now, Richard Cummings is a former international law professor, attorney advisor to USAID. He's a playwright, a novelist, and a member of the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, and is a contributing editor to the American Conservative magazine. And you're led to believe that oil interests aside, neoconservative tendencies to put Israel first aside, that what this is really about is the military-industrial complex sucking off of the U.S. Treasury.
Well, I can go through a few points with you that I think your audience would appreciate knowing, and if I can find it here. Yes. If you go to the article and you click the title, the site that says The Ties That Bind, mm-hmm. you will see that these so-called neocons were all involved in making money off of the defense contractors and related to the war. For example, Richard Perle, who is regarded as one of the top neocons pressing for the war for ideological reasons, is in fact a person who made a great deal of money off of the Boeing company. He had an investment company called Triram Partners, and they received $20 million from Boeing as for a consultancy. He was also on the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board. So there you see that this guy has made plenty of money off of this, and the Boeing company does not only produce civil aircraft, it also produces military aircraft and other weapons for the Pentagon. Then if you go down to Wolfowitz, for example, and everyone considered Wolfowitz to be the big pro-Zionist, pro-war person being encouraged by Israel to do all of this, well, Paul Wolfowitz, currently president of the World Bank, is a former paid consultant to the Northrop Grumman Corporation. Now, in that capacity, Grumman makes the B-2 bomber, which was used in the shock and awe attack. Which is, you know, so he has a financial interest in this. And then, of course, one of the leading characters, Douglas Feith, who had been appointed by Bush to be the Undersecretary of Defense to Donald Rumsfeld, and he was the guy who set up the, cooked the intelligence with the Office of Special Plans, he founded the law firm of Feith and Zell, and one of their major clients included Northrop Grumman. So there's a whole list of people that you could find, and the whole argument that they're somehow involved in neoconservative thought, I disagree. What I'm saying is that the ideology follows the money.
Right. So the definition of a neoconservative, rather really than being an ex-Trotskyite who for ideological reasons became sort of a right-wing nationalist warmonger type, that rather what we're talking about is people who were ex-Trotskyites who became lobbyists for the military-industrial complex.
Well, you know, these... Perle wasn't, I wouldn't say he was an ex-Trotskyite. He was a Jackson, Scoop Jackson Democrat, and so really was Wolfowitz. I don't know Feith's ideological background. Certainly there were plenty of former Trotskyites, neocons, who have become what you call pro-war people, but the ones that actually were the serious players in all of this, that were in the Bush administration, yes, they were, had ties to companies from which they made substantial amounts of money.
Mm-hmm. Now, the article begins here with then the Deputy National Security Advisor, Stephen Hadley, inviting the Director for Strategic Planning from Lockheed Martin.
Strategic Planning, yes.
Inviting him to the White House for a meeting. This is November 2002. And what was the purpose of this meeting?
Okay. Stephen Hadley, at that point the Deputy National Security Advisor, had been a lawyer with Shea & Gould, which was the law firm that represented Lockheed Martin. And he actually did legal work. He lawyered for Lockheed Martin. Well, in this capacity as Deputy National Security Advisor, he called his close friend and fellow colleague from Lockheed, Bruce Jackson, and he said to Jackson, and Jackson told me, and I interviewed him at his apartment in Washington, Jackson told me that Hadley said to him, "We're going to war, and we really need a rationale for this." In other words, they didn't have any specific justification for doing this. They wanted a rationale. So he asked Jackson to set up something like the Committee on NATO, which Jackson had been involved with before with Hadley, and that committee actually pressed for the enlargement of nations of NATO to bring in other countries like Poland. Well, let me just take an aside. As soon as Poland got its membership in NATO, they then began giving Lockheed a contract for $3 billion to buy F-16s. So it was really in Lockheed's interest to expand NATO, to bring in all these countries that had a big up both for their military and turn around and buy Lockheed stock. Well, anyway, Jackson came up with the idea of the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq. And that was to promote the idea of getting rid of Saddam Hussein by force and to use as justification human rights, that Saddam gassed his people, he committed genocide, he crushed the Kurds, you know, all this stuff as a rationale. And Bruce Jackson is a very well-connected person. He got all kinds of people on his board. But he acknowledged that he didn't know, and he began raising money through a very prominent Republican fundraiser named Julie Finley in Washington, who's been on every one of these organizations herself. And when he raised all the money, he then said, "Well, look, I don't know anything about Iraq." He needed someone to do it on the day-by-day basis, and he brought in a guy named Randy Shuneman. Well, Randy Shuneman had been on the staff of Senator Trent Lott, in which capacity he drafted the Iraq Liberation Act, which provided $90 million to the Chalabi's organization.
Now, that was back in 1998,
right? That's right. And the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq had ties to all of these people.
Okay, and now let's hold it right there for a second. When you say the Iraq Liberation Act provided all this money for Ahmed Chalabi, that would be the Iranian spy Ahmed Chalabi who helped provide the lies to convince the American people to go to war against Iraq.
That's right, he founded the Iraq Liberation Fund.
Okay, and now, just to review a bit of what you just said. Stephen Hadley, you say, was formerly a lawyer for the law firm that represents Lockheed.
And he did a lot of the work for Lockheed, definitely. That was in the New York Times.
Right, and then he brings in a Lockheed guy to create a committee to come up with a reason to invade Iraq,
They'd
already decided to do. And this guy, Bruce Jackson, who sets up this group, he had already had experience in this kind of thing, you say, setting up a group back in the 1990s to help try to come up with a justification for bringing the former Warsaw Pact nations in Eastern Europe into NATO, right?
That's correct. He was also a founder of PINAR, the Project for the New American Century, PINAR.
Right. Okay, so I guess, and you bring this up in the article too, you kind of paint this drastic picture of the power of these lobbyists and this revolving door, which isn't even a revolving door, you say, it's really an iron triangle, which is a much stronger metaphor. But then you turn right around and say, yeah, but so what? I mean, isn't that just the game? Yeah, of course there's lobbyists and there's companies and congressmen and these people do business with each other, but, you know, what's so special about this case that this isn't just, you know, the way that business is always done?
Well, what I'm saying in that respect is that's what most people would say. Their reaction would be, what is new? Well, what's new about this is that the Lockheed Martin Corporation, with all of its lobbyists and all the money it gives to Congress, also participated in the decision-making process. Bob Stevens, their CEO, was close to Bush. He was appointed by Bush to direct his Future of Aeronautics Committee, and they met, as Bruce Jackson told me, executives of Lockheed routinely meet with the top Pentagon people. And as the New York Times pointed out, Bob Stevens said, we are part of the decision-making process. This is what is entirely different about this. They are no longer a private company just trying to sell their hardware to the United States government. And by the way, this is not really capitalism because there's no competition. Lockheed gets the lion's share of all of this, and its basic client. They have a few deals that they don't do with the government, but 90% of their work is strictly with the United States government. So that's not what you would really call the free market. And what they did was, they promoted the use of their weapons as a way to win the war in Iraq and told them they could do this on the cheap. In other words, they didn't have to have that many ground troops to do it. You could use air power. And they sold them this bill of goods to use the F-15, the X-16, the Raptor, all the missiles they produced, the air-to-ground, and all their other communication system, and it would be a walkover.
And this is the kind of propaganda, really, that we heard, I would say, basically from right around the mid-1990s, this transformation of the military. I remember an old Wall Street Journal article that said, we're going to transform the military and here are our three options or whatever. And it was basically centered around this idea, as you say, to rely solely on high tech. And basically it seemed to be operating under the premise that the U.S. military would be going in and doing these rapid strikes to depose regimes, and then somebody else would be cleaning up the mess or something, I guess, seemed to be the premise behind it all.
Frankly, they're using the model of the German Blitzkrieg, that when you knock everyone out with your air attack, you need a light force, not necessarily large, moving swiftly to clean up the mess and to defeat your enemy. Mm-hmm. And Germany used this in good effect in Poland and then in France. Although in Poland there was substantial resistance to them, it wasn't as easy as they thought it was going to be. But they nevertheless prevailed. And that, frankly, is the model that Lockheed sold.
And it's underestimating the idea of, well, to use your analogy of World War II, the French resistance. The French government might fall under a blitzkrieg, but there's always going to be insurgents left behind who will still carry on the war, as our soldiers have found out
that's
in Iraq.
That's right, and that's where they missed out. That's basic strategic mistake they made. But when you talk to these guys, and I've been to conferences on terrorism and security that were held in McLean, Virginia, with all kinds of people from the CIA before the war, and they were so arrogant, so absolutely convinced that simply by the use of air power you could knock these people out and you didn't need that many troops on the ground. I heard them say this. They believed it. And they believed it because it was sold to them by Lockheed. Now, at that time, going into the late 90s, when supposedly the Pentagon was changing its strategy to do this, and the Bush administration took over from Clinton, who had cut back the defense budget, Lockheed began getting huge amounts of contracts again, and their stock went from 16 to 75, running up to the war. Now, as most people know who analyze the stock market, events have a way of determining what the market is going to do. And in this case, as I spoke to Bruce Jackson, he was certainly fully aware of the price of Lockheed. All of these people have owned Lockheed in their portfolios. And that was a driving force behind all of this, and it's why I think there's not that much analysis of what's going on. How, I'd like to know what the Sulberger's portfolio includes. I was watching the stock analysis right after the new year on CNBC as to which were the best stocks to have in the next year to put in your portfolio. They all agreed that one of them should definitely be Lockheed.
Well, it only makes sense if you have Republicans in power, right?
Yes. Well, of course, to shift that over a little bit, running up to the war, I discovered that, in general, Lockheed gives almost the lion's share of its contributions to the Republicans in Congress. But running up to the war, you will notice a shift, and that they gave a lot more money than they normally would have to Democratic congressmen and senators. They gave a lot of money to Dianne Feinstein, for example. And for me, when you see all these Democrats who voted for the war, and then they said, oh, we're sorry we did that. Well, in fact, they did it for specific reasons. They were getting a lot of money for Lockheed also in their campaign contributions.
Right. And now in your article, you go through and list must be near a dozen Bush administration officials who are tied directly to Lockheed.
Oh, it's extraordinary. If you read the article, you can go through it easier than I can, but I can simply tell you, first of all, Dick Cheney's wife, Lynn, sat on the Lockheed board for quite a while, running up until Cheney became the vice president. He was paid quite a lot of money for doing this, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, to go to a couple of meetings every year. And Cheney himself has in his portfolio quite a lot of Lockheed stock. But going to the specific people who worked for the Bush administration in the military, that's what you really want to look at. For example, Powell Moore, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Legislative Affairs, serving directly under Rumsfeld.
And now,
from 1983 to 1998, he became Chief of Staff of Republican Fred Thompson of Tennessee, and was also a consultant after Vice President for Legislative Affairs for Lockheed.
And now when you say that his job was Legislative Affairs, that means he's the military's liaison to Congress.
That's correct. And he's a Lockheed guy.
Mm-hmm. And now this kind of reminds me of the famous speech on the last day that Ike Eisenhower was in office, and he warned the American population about the rise of the military-industrial complex. And originally, of course, he wanted to call it the military-industrial-congressional complex.
Well, that's a very interesting point, Scott. Interestingly enough, when I was doing research for my biography of Alan Lowenstein, the Pied Piper, I went to a collection at Temple University, and they were called the Urban Archives. And for some reason or other, they had all of these correspondence for an actual existing committee at that time in the 50s called the Committee of the Military-Industrial Complex. And they had a letterhead with all these CEOs from the major contractors, military contractors, and also a lot of labor leaders. And they would have dinners, and all kinds of famous people would address the dinners, and they were an overt lobby group to increase the defense budget in the name of the national security with the great Soviet Empire threatening us. So this exactly existed in reality.
Uh-huh.
I believe he was referring to that at that time.
And in fact, if I could just throw one more thing in here, as long as I'm interrupting you, Chalmers Johnson points out that the B-2 bomber, that one piece at least of the B-2 bomber is made in every single state of the Union, so that any time that any congressman from anywhere in the country wants to oppose an increase in the budget for that thing, he's going to have to go home and explain to his constituents why he's firing them.
Right. Now, in the case of Lockheed, they've certainly done a lot of that themselves. But people should also know that Lockheed is outsourcing a lot of this stuff now. So one of the advantages in the past was having all these jobs. But for now, for example, once Poland gave the $3 billion contracts to buy F-16s, Lockheed turned around and they're starting to build the F-16s in Poland now. So that was another way to bribe them to getting into NATO. And
right,
all of
and
it.
If I remember that story right, they got the almost a $4 billion loan from America to pay for their $3.5 billion worth of F-16s.
That's exactly correct. Now, if I could just interject how it really works in Washington. Most people think, for example, that Israel has this powerful lobby in the United States and AIPAC, and we give them all this aid, and why should we be giving them all this aid? Because they're a fairly prosperous country, and American congressmen can fly over there at the expense of the taxpayers and get indoctrinated by the Israelis and come back and vote for more aid. If, in fact, you look and see what happens to that aid, you will see that we give most of the aid to Israel in forms of military aid. They then turn around and spend that money on Lockheed products. They've spent billions of dollars on Lockheed products, including the F-16s, which make up their Air Force. They have just entered into a contract with Lockheed worth $5 billion for replacing the F-16s with the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. So this is really how it works, how Tom DeLay really worked the system. And Americans need to know how cynical this all is. Tom DeLay will go to Israel and come back and say, I'm a big supporter of Israel. All conservatives support Israel, and because of our Christian beliefs, we should all support Israel. Okay, fine. So they all fall into line, and they say, Tom is right. He goes back to Congress, and he gets everyone to vote more aid for Israel. So they vote it. Israel gets the billions of dollars. They turn around and spend it on Lockheed products, and Lockheed then contributes heavily to Tom DeLay's campaigns and PACs. So it's a vicious cycle, and that's the way it worked, and
mm-hmm.
still works.
Now, if I can, I want to throw in something here in reference to some of your older articles, which, by the way, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm interviewing Richard Cummings. He wrote the article, Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. It's at playboy.com. And in some of your older articles for lewrockwell.com, you talk about the Rockefeller World Empire, basically the old banking and oil establishment in New York. And I guess back in the day they called it the Yankee Cowboy War, where it was the military-industrial complex was the new rising power that had come up on government money after World War II and was a challenge to the Eastern establishment. So at this point, are they all just merged together into one big establishment, or is the fight that we see between, for example, the guys at the James Baker Institute and the American Enterprise Institute, is that a legitimate squabble going on there?
Well, you can say so. James Baker never really supported this war. He has been general counsel to the Carlyle Group, for example. To this extent, it's not totally monolithic. What I would say the relationship is, if you want to dig even deeper than my article did, and if I do a book on this, I would go into this. The alliances with the military contractors, Lockheed is preeminent in them, but you also have the investment banks that make a lot of money off of these companies, and they made a fortune, Morgan Stanley and others, when Lockheed merged with the Martin Marietta company in order to build the F-35, and Clinton gave the go-ahead for that merger and exempted all kinds of people from the conflict of interest rules that we had. For example, his Secretary of Defense at that time had worked previously for Martin Marietta. That was Perry. So those deals, these mergers that are always taking place, and the spin-offs of new companies, they all provide lucrative deals for the major investment banks. So the alliance really is between the military contractors, preeminently Lockheed, and with the investment bankers, who make a fortune off of this, Lehman Brothers, Morgan Stanley. That's where you get the alliance between East and West.
Mm-hmm. So then the oil men are the ones cut out?
Well, let me tell you, this is very interesting that most people are, I think, mistaken in what the interest of big oil is or was. Big oil, the private oil companies, were absolutely against invading Iraq. They didn't want to do it. They thought it was against their interests. They were working with the Saudis to figure out a way how to get rid of Saddam Hussein and keep all their contracts, but without an invasion. They told Bush they didn't want this invasion. But Bush and his people went ahead because the military contractors were making fortunes off of this, and they had a lot of sway with regard to the Bush administration, as it turned out, more than the oil companies did.
Mm-hmm. So sort of the Rockefeller World Empire created this monster, and then they lost control of it.
More or less. You can't really say that the Rockefellers created Lockheed Martin. That's a long history of the founding.
Well,
of
no,
the
I mean the World Empire itself.
Yes,
and then
true.
They've lost control of it.
Yes, right. People think, for example, it's been described that Lockheed is the company that runs the empire. That's right.
Very interesting. Okay, now, pardon me, but it was 5 or 10 minutes ago that I interrupted you when you were talking about Powell A. Moore and some of the rest of these guys in the administration,
right,
who are part of this revolving door iron triangle between
That's
the
correct.
Military-industrial complex and the executive branch.
Yeah, for example, there was also Albert Smith, Lockheed's executive vice president for integrated systems and solutions, was appointed by Bush to the Defense Science Board. He then appointed former Lockheed chief operating officer Peter B. Teets, undersecretary of the Air Force and the director of National Reconnaissance Office, where he made decisions on the acquisition of Renaissance reconnaissance satellites and space-based elements of missile defense. Then you have former Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta, the only Democrat appointed by Bush to his cabinet. He worked for Lockheed, as did Bush Secretary of the Navy, Gordon England. And Haley Barbour, who at that time was chairman of the Republican National Committee, became governor of Mississippi, was a major Lockheed lobbyist, as was Bush's national campaign manager, Joe Alba. Now, Dick Cheney's son-in-law, Philip J. Perry, was a registered Lockheed lobbyist and had worked for a law firm that represented Lockheed with the Department of Homeland Security. Bush turned around and nominated Philip Perry to the position of general counsel of the Department of Homeland Security, in which capacity he negotiated the contracts with Lockheed, who got a lot of homeland defense contracts. And this is extraordinary. While his wife, Elizabeth Cheney, serves as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Middle Eastern Affairs. So it's all in the family, you might say.
It's hard for me to even think about this without I mean, it's just basic stealing is all it is. It's a bunch of people looting the American treasury. That's all
it is. That's right. The cost runovers on so many of these Lockheed products are extraordinary. The F-35 is an amazing aircraft. No one knows if it will fly. The Government Services Administration said there's been no real review of this. They're paying out all this money, and there's no chance. It's not going to be tested for years.
And, of course, they don't even need the F-35 except to perhaps fight the countries that we sell the F-22 to. Because otherwise, they're overmatched by our F-22s, right?
That's correct.
Never mind our F-15s that were already plenty good enough for any MiG in the world.
Certainly, that's exactly right.
Ah, jeez.
But the interesting thing about the F-35 is how it was involved in bringing Tony Blair and the Brits into the Iraq War.
Oh, really, now?
Yes, it's in the article. And what happened was, and I found this just serendipitously because I was calling up various people in Lockheed to see how the system really works, and I got on the phone with a guy with the name of John Smith, who was with the Lockheed operation in Fort Worth, where they're assembling the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, a deal that's going to be worth over $250 billion for Lockheed. Well, it's not only Lockheed. What Lockheed did was it brought in two other companies with it to make the F-35. They brought in Northrop Grumman, first of all, that they had wanted to acquire, but it was found to be in the violation of the antitrust law, so they couldn't do this. Well, this was a way of sort of partnering with Northrop Grumman and bringing them on the deal. Maybe down the road they'll be able to acquire them. But they also brought in a company called BAE Systems, which is the largest British and the largest European defense contractor. Now, BAE Systems had a history of corruption. They were bailed out by the British government from a bribery scandal in Saudi Arabia, and they were going belly up. Goldman Sachs told them they were not going to be able to pay a dividend. They were going broke. And if Tony Blair lost BAE Systems, Britain would have lost thousands upon thousands of jobs. So what Lockheed did was it brought BAE Systems in on the F-35 contract. Now, after Britain agreed to go in the war and their troops were on the ground, the entire contract was renegotiated and increased in funding by the government to over $20 billion more than they had done before. This did not need congressional approval because they already had the money in there. It's been allocated. Now, what John Smith told me was, all three companies are now part of this deal, and it's paid as an as-needed basis. In other words, every time BAE Systems needs some money from going broke, they can put their hand in the till. This enabled them to not go broke and to build the Typhoon jet, which they are selling to Saudi Arabia. They beat out the Dassault company from France in an Air Force deal worth $70 billion for them. Extraordinary.
That's an incredible amount of money.
Incredible, but they never would have been able to build the Typhoon and sell it to Saudi if they hadn't gotten the F-35 deal through Lockheed to put them back on their feet. They were going bankrupt.
Well, and let's go through some of the planes, some of the most famous planes that Americans know from the Discovery Channel all day. The SR-71, the U-2 spy plane, the F-117 stealth, as you mentioned, the F-22s and F-35s, the F-16s. The Patriot missiles, I didn't realize, I think you say in your article, $9 million a piece. Those are made by Lockheed.
Right.
And satellite guidance systems for all the bombs. I think there's a quote in here that you mention in this article. Anything you need to kill the enemy, they will sell you.
Correct.
They even make nuclear bombs, these guys, right?
Of course, they're in the bomb business. And Clinton said, Bush said, we need to produce more nuclear weapons. Well, that's a very good deal for them. After the article came out, Lockheed got the big contract to build the next advanced spaceship. That's worth hundreds of billions of dollars to them and will carry them on well into the future with lucrative contracts without any bidding. It's extraordinary. And if you look at what happened in shock and awe when we first invaded Iraq, almost all the weapon systems involved in that were from Lockheed.
Really, can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Let me just see if I can find them in the article where shock and awe takes place.
I know we can start with the F-117.
Yes, the F-117 played a very, very significant role in this. Let me just see. Okay, here it is. On March 20th, 2003, America attacked Iraq. Shock and awe began at night with Lockheed Martin's stealth F-17 Nighthawks leading the assault. Looking like gigantic venom and venomous black bats, the V-shaped killers, with their sharply spiked tail wings, swept over Baghdad in search of the concrete shelters and reinforced bunkers where it was believed Saddam Hussein and his inner circle were concealed. Light ground forces moved swiftly towards Baghdad. An American blitzkrieg had been launched. The F-17 had been reconfigured to carry a 2,000-pound bunker buster bomb, accurately guided by new technology to hit its target at a vertical impact angle with a warhead called the BLU-109. The Lockheed Missiles and Space Company manufactured it. Lockheed's Keyhole and La Crosse satellites beamed images from the war back to the military, employing its theater battle management core systems, specialized software used to coordinate communications between intelligence systems and ground forces to assist the air campaigns. Lockheed U-2s and SR-71s Blackbird spy planes, by the way, that's an amazing plane which has just been mothballed, joined with its F-16s and F-A-22 jet fighters, those are the Raptors, in support of the F-117s. Army and Marine ground troops unleashed Lockheed Hellfire quasi laser-guided and armor missiles to demolish helicopters and land attack vehicles, and PAC-3 missiles, a highly agile hit-to-kill interceptor to provide air defense for ground forces. Lockheed Javelin portable missiles were used to considerable effect, particularly later in the invasion of Fallujah. And then I'd point out Lockheed's arsenal of democracy was in full display. So here you have the whole armory that Lockheed produced used in shock and awe, using these planes, using these missiles, fortunes of money being spent on this.
Yeah, and if I can just point out, that original attack that you described with those F-117s was against Doha Farms, where some of Chalabi's defectors had said Saddam Hussein was hiding.
That's
and of
right.
course, all they did was kill innocent people. Saddam
That's
Hussein
correct.
Wasn't there for the decapitation strike.
That's right.
Just, you know, throw that in there, that the high explosives that were going off were only ripping apart the bodies of innocent people, not the targets.
Well, that's true. So in many ways, this was counterproductive, because although it made the actual invasion of Iraq simpler, and they did prevail and they knocked out Saddam Hussein, they also engendered the insurgency by doing all these things and creating all this resentment.
Mm-hmm. And now, again, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio, and I'm speaking with Richard Cummings. He wrote an article that's currently at Playboy.com. It's called Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. And we're talking about this industry, the military-industrial complex, that takes tax money and turns it into weapons, and how Lockheed basically decided as a business strategy that it was time for them to decide the policy. First of all, they were not going to try to compete in the free market anymore. They were going to run off government contracts. But then they decided they were going to decide what the government was going to do so that they would know where to invest for those government contracts, and how they've basically played a large role in taking over the foreign policy of the United States just so they can sell their planes and their bombs.
That's exactly right.
And again, you said the stock price went from what to what?
It went from 16.3 to 73.5, and then up, it's not in my article, it went up to 75 from 73.
Okay,
and
now
over 80.
And now back to the narrative about exactly what role Lockheed played in getting us into the war. You point out, of course, that Stephen Hadley, who is a former lawyer for Lockheed, as Deputy National Security Advisor, is the guy who at least publicly took the blame for leaving the infamous 16 words about uranium from Niger in the State of the Union speech in 2003, which again was, you know, one of two parts of the so-called evidence, the other being the aluminum tubes, that Saddam Hussein had an active nuclear weapons program
well,
and had to be preempted.
Let me just interject about the aluminum tubes, because we had so much editing in my article that somehow that's not in there. Stephen Hadley also told Karl Rove to suppress the fact that the intelligence agency were telling Bush that the aluminum tubes were not for making nuclear weapons, but for simple normal missiles. And he told Rove that he'd better suppress that, because if it came out during the election in 2004, Bush would lose.
Mm-hmm. And that was in the article, and unfortunately
ended up
on the
floor. Original form. My contract provided for 7,000 words. I wrote 15,000 words.
Yeah.
The more you get into this, the more fascinating it is, and the more convoluted you find all of these machinations. So some of the stuff we had to cut out, but that was in there originally. But people need to know that, too.
Mm-hmm. And now, back at the beginning, we were talking about this guy, Bruce Jackson.
Yes.
And this committee that he set up, the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq,
right,
that brought in all these other Lockheed lobbyists, neoconservative types.
Right.
And then that is basically, I think you say in the article, the committee was disbanded in June 2003. They weren't that concerned with liberating the Iraqis once the regime was had fallen.
Well, according to Bruce Jackson, he told me that his whole rationale for human rights he thought was a legitimate one. But Hadley told him that they were not going to rely on that any longer. They were going to rely on weapons of mass destruction. So Jackson's whole rationale was no longer needed, but it certainly launched it. You may remember the sequence of Bush's speeches. At the beginning, when Bush was trying to get America involved in a war with Iraq to eliminate Saddam Hussein, his arguments were all based on the Committee for Liberation of Iraq's arguments. He gassed his own people. He committed genocide. Children are dying. You know, he uses torture. All this stuff. And by the way, the worst crimes committed by Saddam Hussein took place at a time when he was our ally. You know, by the time the second Iraq war took place, he wasn't doing any of these things. The Kurds had virtually gotten all their autonomy, as had a lot of the Shiite communities. And he was really losing his grip in the country. That was what is so extraordinary.
Well, there's a major exception to that, which is the slaughter of the Shia after the Gulf War, when Bush Sr. told them to rise up and then left them high and dry like the Bay of Pigs.
Right, that was also like the Hungarian Revolution.
Right, so we didn't really back Saddam in that. It was just all America's fault that he got away with it and did it in the first place.
Yeah, but we sort of didn't care, you know, because his job originally was to suppress all of these people because he was a Sunni and we feared the Shiite influence coming from Iran. Now, this has all come back to haunt us because as a result of this war, Iran is getting the exact power that it had sought anyway. And if people should know that we encouraged Saddam Hussein to invade Iraq, invade Iran. I was at meetings in New York where various Iraqi officials spoke. Tariq Aziz, I heard Tariq Aziz speak and say, give us the weapons and we'll do the job. We'll stop this fundamentalist revolution in its tracks. And there were all kinds of top brass and bankers and military people and intelligence people all cheering wildly while Angie Biddle Duke embraced him. Well, you see, Saddam Hussein then went and did that. And when he did it, and he saved Kuwait and Saudi Arabia from the Iranian Revolution, the Al-Sabahs, who were the family that ruled Kuwait, turned around and said, now you have to pay us back all the money we lent you. Well, at that point, he couldn't do it. So he asked the American ambassador, what would happen if I attacked Kuwait? What would you do? And she said, nothing. She called up the White House and she came back. She said, we won't do anything. So he went and did it. So it's extraordinary, the whole story.
Yep, and in fact, the more we learn about that, and it's hard, though, because you never know who's making up and changing their role when they talk about it now. But Baker basically meant for Saddam to kneecap the Kuwaitis for producing more than their quota from the shared oil wells at the border region there. But he wasn't supposed to take the whole country, but in Woodward's latest book, he says that even when he did, James Baker didn't really care and actually opposed the war.
That's right.
That it was Margaret Thatcher and Brent Scowcroft who convinced Bush to go ahead and do it. And Scowcroft, of course, I think it was Rothbard who documented Scowcroft's extensive financial ties with the Kuwaitis, which was his interest in recommending war. But originally, James Baker, who had given the green light to Saddam Hussein through April Glaspie, as you say, according to Woodward's latest book anyway, didn't even want to undo the invasion once he had gone too far.
That's right. Well, what you have to know that Lockheed had a lot of Lockheed products used in that first war as well. Very, very many of them, the F-117s particularly.
Mm-hmm. And now also, you talk about this guy, Bruce Jackson, who had experience in the 1990s going and organizing the former Eastern European Soviet bloc states into NATO, that he basically went back in the run-up to the Iraq War and said, hey guys, remember me? Okay, I want you to sign this joint statement agreeing with us about the threat that Saddam Hussein represents.
That's the Vilnius 10, exactly right.
And what effect did that have in the larger sense?
It had an enormous effect because it counteracted all the opposition from the war coming from France, for example.
Old Europe, that is.
Yes, that was old Europe, and the people that Jackson had brought into NATO were the new Europe.
Mm-hmm. And this is sort of America surrounding the European Union with NATO members so that they don't break off and make their own army outside of the NATO alliance, right?
That's correct, and also to intimidate the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of all that, Lockheed got a great many contracts from any number of those countries, particularly Poland.
Which is why, you know, before too long, Americans in F-35s will be fighting Poles in F-22s or F-16s,
I guess.
Who knows?
But it doesn't matter for Lockheed. Let me... This is an interesting thing that just came up, which shows you how Lockheed really works. Just the other day, China knocked out one of its obsolete satellites with a newly accurate ballistic missile. And everyone is saying, oh, how terrible is going to be a new arms race in space. But none of these articles in the newspapers pointed out that Lockheed Martin had sold to China advanced technology to make their ballistic missiles more accurate, as well as advanced satellite technology. They were hauled before a government board, which fined them $14 million for being in violation of the Arms Export Control Act. Well, a mere $14 million was simply a slap on the wrist for these people.
Uh-huh.
So as far as China, Lockheed is concerned, they started this space war. They gave China the technology, which they damn well knew China would use, and then America would have to turn around and give them contracts to counteract that.
And now, if I remember right, Bill Clinton turned around and signed a waiver that had been passed up to him by John Wong in the Commerce Department that basically legalized what Lockheed was in trouble for giving the Chinese, and so ended the prosecution.
That's right.
It's funny how they just impeached him for the sex scandal, isn't it?
I couldn't believe that. I thought this was treason. I thought it was unbelievable what happened. It was shocking.
And again, the Justice Department was prosecuting, and what Clinton did basically was thwart the Justice Department. The prosecution, or the Justice Department, ended up not even collecting on the fine or anything, right?
That's right.
It killed the prosecution.
So they weren't prosecuted, but they still were found in violation, and the State Department it was that fined them $14 million, but they never had criminal prosecution.
Right. It's funny how all these scandals kind of run together, isn't it?
It is unbelievable. Well, Clinton was getting some campaign contributions from sort of devious Chinese sources, some of which had to be returned.
Let's talk about the domestication of this war. And, well, for example, the fact that Lockheed is intimately involved in the new border fence and the virtual high-tech fence going on the Mexican border.
Right.
That seems like the kind of basically taking the technology that we use against the Iraqis, you know, making them line up and give eyeball scans to travel between here and there and that sort of thing. And basically they're bringing home all this technology. They got to sell it to somebody, so they're going to sell it to the Border Patrol now.
They're also
to Homeland
quite
Security.
A lot of it to Homeland Security. As I say, Dick Cheney's son-in-law is the general counsel. They're selling a lot. They have quite a lot of contracts with Homeland Security worth billions of dollars, and they have a huge IT division now. It's really extraordinary how much they do in that capacity. And all these subcontractors in Washington are making a lot of money through them as well. Corpbar pointed out that Lockheed got a contract to do interrogations, and they're not responsible to anybody.
Right, right. That was another part, was the contract. This company, Cytex.
That's right.
So rather than if we get, say, in the future arrested by the Department of Homeland Security, we can look forward to being interrogated by private contractors rather than police?
Yeah, Lockheed bought Cytex, and then they then became involved in contracts to do interrogation, yes.
Well, I look forward to that. Am I still going to be able to talk to my lawyer, or...
By then, who knows?
Well, and these guys you say in the article were involved in Abu Ghraib, right? These same contractors were involved in, and I think you even mentioned the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan too, right?
Well, that's true.
It is
so bizarre. They really have taken over the country. It's no question, but it's true.
And what was their involvement in Abu Ghraib and Bagram? These guys were actually, you know, in there with the rest of the rings of torturers, or what role did they play?
Well, they were doing interrogations, of course. That's what they had the contract to do.
Mm-hmm. And then, as you say, the military code of or uniform code of military justice doesn't cover them.
No, it does not. They are exempt from that. Certainly, that's true.
And the American Penal Code doesn't apply to them when they're in other countries on contract to the American government.
That's right.
And then whatever government, whatever country they're in, their law doesn't apply to them either because they're there with us.
So basically there's nothing anyone can do to them. Really, it's quite true.
And, you know, Chris Hedges wrote something at truthout.org not long ago about Blackwater, basically tying this together and talking about how you literally have sheriff's departments and, you know, local city police departments in America who are now hiring Blackwater guys and granting them police power and basically deputizing them.
Yes, well, this is an extraordinary development for privatization. There's a lot of money to be made in many aspects as well. And certainly, without regard to Lockheed, the reconstruction, supposedly, of Iraq was a total boondoggle. Billions of dollars to people, simply because they had good Republican connections, were in all kinds of businesses there, restoring the factories, doing all kinds of, about which they knew nothing. And they went away with billions of dollars of profits.
Right. And you point out that this is not real privatization in the sense of government getting out of the business and letting the free market handle it. This is government contracts. This is basically just socialism for people who were born rich.
That's exactly right. And I just hope and pray that American people get enough information to understand what this is about. Now, when Eisenhower was president, we had a very strong defense, but he knew where the waste was. He didn't get fooled. He was able to cut the defense budget substantially without impinging at all on our national security. But with these guys, there's no such thing as a gigantic pork barrel.
Mm-hmm. And really, a pork barrel at, what, $700 billion a year almost, if you combine
that. That's going to go up way up. It's projected that that's going to increase substantially. Yes, it will. And Lockheed is getting the lion's share of those contracts.
And you say they spend $10 million a year lobbying congressmen.
Yeah, they have. As Bruce Jackson told me, they spend all this money on lobbyists, and the lobbyists hire other lobbyists. Like, Washington is run by K Street. American people need to know this. Their congressmen, elected congressmen, are not regarded as very, very serious players in the Capitol. If you go to the Capitol Grill, for example, where I went to lunch with a friend of mine who was a federal court judge, he pointed out all the people having lunch there. They were all these rich lobbyists. And they have these little special cases in the wall where they put all their vintage wines and ports. You can see, and their names are on the cabinets. This lobbyist firm, that lobbyist firm. And you can just see it. It's extraordinary. And there's thousands and thousands of dollars worth of rare old vintage wines in Capitol Grill where they go. And I was told that congressmen have to wait to get seats, but not the Lockheed lobbyists. They walk right in and are given the best tables.
Yeah, yeah. Congressmen are a dime a dozen,
right? A dime
right?
A dozen, as this guy told me. That's exactly right.
Now, what's the solution to this? I think in your article you cite someone saying, well, they should just nationalize the whole industry.
That was told to me by former Congressman Otis Pike in a private conversation. He was chairman of the House committee that was investigating the CIA. He had been a total hawk. He had been a Marine, and he was pro-Vietnam War. But after it was over, he told me, it's a catastrophe what's happening, and we really need to take over the military contractors because they run everything.
Well, but then you just have the steel companies who provide the steel to the nationalized weapons makers, and you have the very same deal with the steel lobbyists then, right?
Well, right.
I mean, ultimately.
But I don't think that's really practical to do. What I do think we can do, that was Otis Pike who said that, number of things that we could do. The first thing that we ought to do was what the British did during the First World War. They imposed a war profits tax on the country, on the companies that were making money off of the war, saying it's only right that they should pay for this themselves. And we should impose a war profits tax on companies like Lockheed. That's one thing that we should do. And the second thing that we should do is absolutely forbid military contractors like this or any private companies doing business with the government from making any political contributions. That is absolutely essential. All these paltry reforms about not being able to buy these people's congressmen lunch is just a joke. The real problem is the contributions that they're able to make, and those should be prohibited.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, ultimately, the problem really is the power to abuse. I mean, as long as we have a $2.7 trillion annual budget for this national government and, you know, military bases in the vast majority of nations on Earth, somebody's going to wiggle into this spot and figure out, you know, how to make their millions or billions off of this till.
That's true.
Ultimately, what we have to do is end the empire.
Right. We need to become a real democracy, and this has really corrupted it, and we're not. But another thing that we could do as well, Scott, is apply the antitrust laws to Lockheed. We enabled them to merge with Martin Marietta to build the F-35, and Clinton gave all those waivers so they could do it. But they have a huge IT division. If you force Lockheed under the antitrust laws, because they have such a dominant position in the market, to divest itself of its IT component, this would in no way damage America's national security, but it would greatly diminish Lockheed's power to force actions that are in their own interests. So that's something that really needs to be thought about also. We could do those things.
Do you see Bruce Jackson and Lockheed pushing for war against Iran?
Oh, I didn't... I would substantially expect that they are, and Bruce would be doing it for human rights reasons, you know.
Oh, he's a very caring guy, this Bruce Jackson.
A very fascinating person. I spent 3 hours with him in his apartment talking to him at length. He's a very, very intelligent person. His father was the National Security Advisor to Eisenhower, the first person to hold that position. So he comes to this naturally.
And so you believe he's genuine when he wants to overthrow the government of Iran because he cares so much for the people of Persia?
It's very interesting because he both is sincere and, on the other hand, he's a substantial holder of Lockheed stock.
Yes.
I mean, so his sincerity is, you know, compounded by his own self-interest. I think in some, he's married to a woman who's a big activist in Belarus. Her husband was disappeared by the Belarus government, and he was declared dead, and finally he married her. He's on all these other committees for human rights and democracy in Eastern Europe and all this stuff, but let's be honest, it does turn around and benefit him and anyone else who owns the Lockheed stock.
Right. Well, okay, let's wrap up these last few minutes here. I want to ask you, is the National Review a CIA front?
Well, James Burnham was CIA and William Buckley was CIA. They started the thing. And it's very interesting to me that the National Review started very much at the same time as the Paris Review, which I disclosed was a CIA front. So a lot of intelligence officers were involved in the founding of the National Review. Whether they actually got the money from them, I don't know. But I do know Paris Review was giving the money, backing the Paris Review, the literary magazine. So they funneled money to them. There's a British scholar who was doing a study of all the major American publishing companies, magazines, and publishing entities that got CIA money. And for all I know, they did. I mean, Buckley's ties to the CIA were strong. And so James Burnham's remains strong. So I wouldn't be surprised if they got some money under the table from them.
Yeah. And really, they were recruiting out of Skull and Bones. That's George Bush's connection.
That was the main place where people got recruited to CIA. Yale was the primary one. But they got them from Princeton, Harvard, all these elitist places. And that was the time when the CIA was an old boys network.
Yeah, and you talk about in your book, or your article for LouRockwell.com on this subject, you talk about the, I believe, the president or the chairman of Harcourt Brace, one of the most powerful publishers in America, and that he was CIA.
That's right.
That being a publisher was literally his cover?
That was Robie McCauley, and it was not Harcourt Brace, it was, the one in Boston, Susan Mifflin. Robie McCauley told me at lunch, when I was having discussions with him, he said, well, you know, Richard, my whole job with Houghton Mifflin was my cover for running the entire Sub-Sahara CIA Africa operation. He told it to me.
Yeah. And now, it's interesting, you know all these guys, and you say you were in the room when they made the deal with Tariq Aziz to back Saddam against Iran. Who are you, man?
Well, I'm just a writer, but I did work for USAID, and I taught international law at Haile Selassie University in Ethiopia. I was at that meeting at the River Club because I was a friend of Tony Dukes in East Hampton, who ran Boys Harbor, which was a summer camp. I live out here in the Hamptons. I became friendly with Tony. And through Tony, I became friends with his brother, Angie Biddle Duke, who had been head of protocol in the State Department and founded his own kind of organization, very similar to you know, the Foreign Council on Foreign Relations, but Angie ran it, and he would invite me to these breakfasts that took place at 8 o'clock in the morning in the River Club. And one of them that I was invited to was to hear Tariq Aziz speak. And let me tell you, that was a fascinating incident. I heard all of it. I said, this is crazy, when they began attacking Saddam Hussein. I heard that we had this alliance with him, and we got Saddam Hussein to invade Iran because we were fearful of the spread of the Iranian fundamentalist Muslim revolution.
Yeah. And
so
now
that's
you
all
say,
true.
As you say, Bush Jr. has reversed the policy and imported the Iranian revolution to Iraq.
Isn't that incredible? It is so bizarre. Thomas Johnson calls that blowback, and boy, is it ever. Unbelievable. They had no foresight with regard to this, which makes you wonder what they really think in the intelligence agencies. I mean, I don't know who's really in the CIA these days and who these people are, but they don't seem to have a great deal of sophistication, and they're very naive. When I went to this big meeting, I as a journalist, I got a waiver because I'm also a member of the association. It's now called Four Intelligence Officers. And how I joined that was when my book, The Pied Piper, came out, and I was getting trashed all over the place for saying Alec Lowenstein, the great civil rights and anti-war activist, was CIA. I got a phone call from a classmate of mine from Princeton who had been in intelligence, and he said, Richard, you've got to come to some of these meetings and meet these people. You'll learn some more stuff. So I and about eight other writers were invited to become members of the New England chapter of the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, where people tell you all this stuff off the record.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really fascinating to go to the meetings, and people would tell me all of these things. Roby is now dead, so I feel it's fair I can discuss what he told me.
Wow, well, it's very interesting. I kind of picture this axis between Houston and the Council on Foreign Relations in New York on one hand, and the neocons and the military-industrial complex on the other. But I never really found too many good sources of information fleshing out the military-industrial complex's role in this, at least, you know, contemporarily, in regards to the Iraq War and the Bush Doctrine. So really appreciate your perspective on this.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of sources. I did a lot of research. People should know that when you write an article for Playboy, it's fact-checked to death, and then the lawyers vet it. So that this went on endlessly, and I had to produce all my documents. They have everything in their files, every document that I use, every source I had, the transcript of my interview with Jackson and with John Smith. They're all in the offices of Playboy magazine. They are there on the record.
And the article is Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. It's available at Playboy.com.
That's
right,
correct,
now.
Sir.
Thank you very much for your time.
My
today,
pleasure.
Sir.
I really appreciate it, sir.
All right, everybody. This has been Anti-War Radio for January 30th, 2007. Here's Captain Lockheed and the Starfighters with Franz Josef Strauss, Defense Minister.
Himself would laugh at that antiquated aeroplanes. We must modernize. We must join in the supersonic race. We must get up to date. Get with it. We must completely reorganize the strategic air defense again. Strategic air defense system that will astound the world. There must be a dramatic renaissance of the Luftwaffe. The long reawakening. The long-awaited reawakening of German air supremacy. Out of the ashes of defeat, a shining silver bird arising. We will soar up the skies with our gleaming needles. The world will be